Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Stuart Copeland is best known as the drummer for The Police, the rock band, not the institution of public safekeeping. He is widely regarded as one of the maybe 10 best drummers of all time. Certainly for me growing up in the 1980s, he was a hero, an enigmatic, terrifying rock and roll god. So when he appeared on my itinerary as a guest for Wheels Off, I got a little scared, a little nervous, not gonna lie. But guess what? You're never gonna believe this. Or maybe you've already guessed. Super cool dude. Super nice guy. Couldn't have been kinder, funnier, more generous with his time and his wisdom. So erudite and well-spoken. I can't even believe that I just spent a half an hour having laughs and conversation with the great Stuart Copeland, you guys. This is definitely a high point for me. Certainly as an interviewer, but as a rock and roll fan, not going to lie, I got very lucky to do this, to have this conversation today with him. This Wheels Off series is truly the gift that keeps on giving for me. I think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed partaking in it. You should know, because you won't be able to see the video as you are listening, that during the whole second half of our conversation, he paced in rapid circles around his recording studio. And you would never guess that this guy is 70 years old. He's spry and young and quick-witted and sharp and handsome. And wow, I'm all a-tingle. Please enjoy listening to this episode of Wheels Off, featuring the great Stuart Copeland. Welcome to Wheels Off, Stuart Copeland. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
Very good. It's good to be with you.
Nice. For the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
I am logging in from Los Angeles, California, where the sun is not shining today.
Yeah. Are you covered in smoke from the Canadian fires like we are in New York?
Maybe that's what it is. It's all overcast, but no, I don't think that's what we're seeing. This is just California June gloom.
Of course, you know, yeah.
We have summer all year except for June.
Ironic.
For some reason. Yeah, ironic. You know, normally the sky is blue, the birds are singing, the rattlesnakes are biting, the mountain lions are chasing cyclists, earthquakes are shattering lives, forest fires. You know, it's great out here.
It looks like you're in a recording studio.
Yes, this is the Sacred Grove, where my fancy friends come to play. Love and it. I've got everything is all mic'd up. I got the largest collection of the cheapest music instruments that money can buy. And it's all line check set up. I'm kind of a studio geek, and this is my train set. And I've got it all, so I just hit record, the whole room is in record. The drums, the piano, the amps, the microphones, everything is on and in record. So my chuckle buddies come over, unfortunately, Taylor Hawkins and Neil Peart no more.
Yeah. But,
Snoop Dogg and Ben Harper and Stanley Clarke and others, they come over here and we just jam.
Nice.
And I got cameras around the room too. And I cut them up, these jams that cut the 15 minutes down to a manageable 8 minutes, and put it up on YouTube. And you can see it there. So-and-so at the Sacred Grove. Look for the Sacred Grove.
Nice. And Ben Harper was a recent guest on Wheels Off. Great dude.
Yeah.
Josh,
a slide player.
Oh, incredible. Is Josh Fries, has he ever been in there?
Well, we're good buddies, and he hasn't made it. Now he's got like this big gig, so I'm probably not going to be seeing much of Josh. He's a busy guy.
Yeah, he is.
In fact, we all knew that he got the Foo Fighters gig when he has to call up Danny Elfman and say, "Oh, sorry, I can't make rehearsals." And he has to call up Devo and say, "I'm sorry, guys, can't make this tour." And so I remember the predicament that Josh must have been in. He can't tell nobody why he's not doing, but hold on just a minute there, pal. So we all had this kind of figured out in advance. And I remember when we did the big Police reunion tour, I was in the same thing, because at that time I was a professional film composer and hanging out. And we knew like 6 months out that we were going to be doing this, and I had to keep real quiet about it. And so my composer buddies are saying, "So, Stuart, what are you working on now? What movie are you working on now?" And I go, "Not much. I'm working on my solo album." and in film composing world, working on your solo album means you are out of work.
Yeah.
And people, "Oh, gosh, dude, I should introduce you to my agent, man. You should be working."
Well, to that end, is there a creative project you're working on right now? And if so, how does it light you up?
Oh, nothing really. Just working on my solo album.
No. So you're in the food.
I'm working on all kinds of stuff. And it is as pathetic as it sounds, actually, because I'm not employed as a film composer anymore. I don't do that anymore. I write art for art's sake. And I know this is going to be kind of a conversation stopper and a disappointment to many. But I spend my days now writing opera.
Nice.
Which is sort of like film composing, only the pay is crap because it's art for art's sake. The business model for the opera companies is to lose money. But that's what makes it so fun, because it's fully creative. There are no studios breathing down our neck. And the opera house has a theater. They've got an orchestra in the pit. They've got the singers on stage. They've got all this infrastructure for me to come in and do music and drama, which is what film scoring was all about. But instead of working for the man, it's all in service of art.
It comes up a lot in these conversations with creative people about the idea of art when it's on consignment, when you've been given an assignment to do a piece of art, or when you're making art and you're trying to calculate what you think your audience wants.
Well, those are two very, very different things, actually.
Okay.
You very cleverly identified two very specific streams of artistic consciousness. The first, which is employment for hire. For 20 years, I was a film composer, hired gun, flinty-eyed, pay me money, I'll give you music. You want happy? I'll give you happy. You want sad, happy, sad? Sad, happy, maybe? And that's not so much art as craft. And boy, you don't develop yourself as an artist so much that way, but you sure do learn some stuff. Because under the heavy yoke of cruel employment, you have to go places that you wouldn't go instinctively as an artist. And so I had to learn orchestra. And that was a byproduct. I had an involuntary education in orchestra. And man, do I appreciate that. That's better than all the hard cash money that I got paid, was that experience of learning how to use orchestra. Now, the art side, now that I don't do that anymore, I'm the second part of your point, which is art for art's sake. What does the world want from me? Which is tempered by, what do I want to say? And in my later year, in my winter years, I can pretty much go with what I want to say rather than what my audience expects of me. They do expect me to be banging shit. And I'm doing that. I'm doing that with the Police Deranged for Orchestra. I will be playing, if I haven't already, I'll be playing in your city with your orchestra, banging stuff, which is what people expect of me. The opera part is what I want to do, and it's deeply engrossing. It's just the most fun a musician can have with his clothes on. Working with music and storytelling is really very intoxicating.
And when you're making art for art's sake, as you call it, and it's not the opera that's really feeding your soul, but it's stuff where you're trying to really figure out what people are going to want. What do you run into when it comes to, do you ever feel like you're calculating something, chasing what you think they would want? Has that ever happened to you? Do you feel like that has had an adverse effect?
Yeah, the Police started as exactly that. The world wanted punk. Okay, I can do that. I can make a punk band. We'll call ourselves something about the Bathrooms. The Police. Oh, that'll piss everybody off. Okay, I got me a punk rock band called The Police because it was a happening scene. And it was totally a uniform of convenience, a flag that was flying and flapping in the wind. So sure, we'll march under that flag because it was because the old scene, progressive rock, was withering on the vine. No wind in those sails. And so The Police started out as a complete calculation.
And yet it wasn't inauthentic.
Well, it was pretty inauthentic. It was pretty inauthentic at the start. For me, it wasn't, because I like that stuff. I love the Cramps and the Sex Pistols, yes, and the Clash and the Damned. And I love all that stuff. And for me, it was great fun. For old Stingo, you know, he is a sensitive soul with a deep heart and a big mind. Mm-hmm. And fuck off, everybody, wasn't quite, you know, fulfilling artistically for him, but he stuck with it, you know, with my songs that we started out with, which were bass lines with yelling, because it was a happening scene. And we felt like we were moving forward even with crap material. Then Andy Summers showed up with his fancy harmonic sophistication, and that's where Sting discovered, and we all discovered, that guy can write songs. And so Andy was able to play the stuff that he would conceive of, and that's when The Police really found our groove, is when Sting started writing songs. But that was 2 years in, by the way. Wow. And we starved together with crap material, Flag of Convenience, pretending to be a punk band for 2 years. God knows what kept us together.
But I think that makes a compelling argument for, every once in a while, the Flag of Convenience, as you call it, or the calculation, there's value in it. Like, it can get you somewhere where then the art can take over. There's room for what maybe is more expressive or connected to
Absolutely.
Your soul.
I would say to any young musician, do not be afraid of selling out, because your art, selling what you can do, whether you're a keyboard player, a guitarist, or a songwriter, whatever it is, how you make music, selling it is not a bad thing. That's what troubadours have done since time immemorial. You know, Mozart got paid to write that incredible art that he created. So the upside is, the downside is you're not following your dream, but the upside is you're learning stuff. Yeah. And you're going places involuntarily that you will derive great benefit from. And so selling out is not necessarily a bad thing.
This is so great. I wonder if you'd be willing to describe for the audience the moment when you knew you were going to be a musician. Was there an epiphany moment? Was there a light bulb? Do you remember it? Or was it even pre-consciousness for you?
Well, the light bulb went on and off and on and off a few times. As a kid, as soon as I was immersed in music, that's all that was happening in my brain. It's from 7 years old or something. Then I started banging stuff. And that, you know, hitting drums just turned me from a little squirt, a little runt of the litter, late developer, into a 800-pound hairy-ass silverback swinging through the trees instantly with that volume and that bombast. So it's always been kind of right at the center of my thinking. But then I went to school, and then I went to college, and I thought I was going to be a journalist or something else, but playing in bands and so on. Because all that time, while I was in college, I was tour managing and roadieing for my brother Miles's roster of bands. And so I was seeing music from the side of the business, from the roadie, and I was a DJ at my college station in UC Berkeley. And so I saw that from that, but I kept playing. And so going back and forth in front of the camera, behind the camera, And I pretty much decided I was going to not do it for a living, but be in the music business. But the music kept drawing me back. It kept pulling me back. And I kept finding myself in the band with Curved Air. I started out as their tour manager. And then I found myself in the band. And with the Police, I was in the band, but I was also the tour manager at the same time.
That's rough. I tried that with my own band, and it's tough to get your bandmates to follow your directions when they're cranky in the morning.
Well, it was easy when it was Sting and Henry, because they appreciated that they didn't want to worry about the truck. They didn't want to worry about what time we got to meet. They didn't want to worry about booking gigs, creating posters, designing single sleeves and all that. They were quite happy. Then Andy joined. That little son of a bitch had an opinion, which was good news and bad news. Good news, because now I got somebody to deal with, and we would exchange. Now there's two sharks in the tank. And so I really appreciate it. But now I had to run decisions. We had to like have conversations, and I couldn't just decide, okay, we got the photographs, the contact sheet. Well, we'll use that shot, and that shot. Now I got to have a debate. But it was a good debate, because Andy's standards were higher than mine. I was in a hurry. He would say, hang on a minute. You know, that gig you played there before, going back, you could probably get more money out of that guy. And so that was an upgrade as far as the Police management was concerned.
God, and with your whole family in the business, I mean, it's you must have been plugged in.
Absolutely. I was the great beneficiary of my brother, Ma, and Ian. My brother Ian was an agent who represented everybody. And between the two of them, they actually brought the new wave from England over to America. Ian created the club circuit. Miles sent bands, and with his record label, IRS Records, with the, you know, REM, the Go-Go's, Bangles, Cramps, you know, the list is endless. Miles had his office, and I operated myself out of his offices, and I was the beneficiary of his Rolodex and his connection. So I was able to make things happen. That was half of the bamboozle that I told Sting when he came down to London and returned my call. I said, yeah, I got it all going on. We got gigs. We got the band, really cool name, the Police, and we're going to kick ass, and it's all happening, which he believed. And the rest is history.
You have always struck me as someone who doesn't suffer from the sort of inner turmoil as much as maybe like the tortured artist cliche a lot of people I talk to, but I've never spoken to someone that doesn't admit to having some like internally generated obstacles, stuff that they come up against, whether it's Roseanne Cash talked about success guilt or imposter syndrome or just, you know, garden variety anxiety. I wonder, when you come up against those internally generated obstacles, what have you figured out as a way to get past that?
Well, of course, I am a tortured soul. My heart bleeds with sorrow and the silent miseries of my life. But you know what? You wake up and you make the call. You look down your list of stuff to do today, and you just start with item one and pick up the phone or whatever it is you got to do. And actually, I am racked by guilt, but it doesn't last. I think it's something to do with brain chemistry in the morning, pre-caffeine, post-caffeine, whatever. But that sense of guilt, achievement, obstruction, whatever, has to do with your brain chemistry, not to do with actual circumstances. I know this, and I'm sure Roseanne knows this as well, that even when you're on top of the world, it seems like you're facing insurmountable obstacles. And I can't do this. I've got nothing. Wait a minute. I just won another Grammy. And still you're going to have these. So they're not related to actual reality. They're related to the state of caffeination at that particular time of day. And if you don't like how you're feeling, check in an hour later.
I like that. I wonder, because I don't know that I've ever, I mean, I guess I've talked to some people that have ridden big waves, but I wonder, I'm 18 years your junior, what those years in the 80s, the synchronicity, like the apex of the apex, when you were going through that, I mean, if you don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
What's it like to be at the top of that wave?
It is anomalous. Good question. Because it's not, yes, there are the riotous parties. There is everything that you imagine of show business and the glitterati, of course. Yes, that's all happening. And yet, it's all kind of unsettling. There is a thing that you could call social vertigo, where, yeah, I'm way up high, but the ground sure is way down there now. And there's kind of an anxiety that goes with it all, which makes no sense. You're getting what you always dreamed of, you know, more love, appreciation, and admiration than you ever thought would be possible. And yet there is such a thing as too much adoration. It actually can be unsettling. And this is not a complaint. This is not, you know, of course my heart bleeds with sorrow. Of course, we can discuss that. But it's a strange thing that along with all of that cool stuff is some weirdness. Yeah. And I guess it's sort of like a vertigo. The stakes are higher because a simple thing, you walk into a room as a normal civilian and you walk into a room. You walk into a room as Mick Jagger and you're like a shining light in the room. Everybody stops what they're doing and looks around to see what you got to say, and you better have something useful to say. And the upside is whatever dumb shit you do say is either hilariously funny, scathingly biting, or devastatingly, your words are amplified, and for good or bad. And it takes a lot of mojo to be the big guy. And it's that, I think, causes some anxiety. You know, it's like you're driving a giant avatar. And the avatar is what people know. They see the picture in the papers. They see it on YouTube. That's the character. That's the avatar. The skinny runt, actually, who is that guy, is got to. He woke up this morning, took a piss, and put on his pants. You know, and so you're this little guy driving this big avatar. It's like you're driving a giant truck into the cocktail party, and you got to be careful where you drive that thing. You know, because if you're just walking in driving a normal car, that's a lot easier in a weird kind of way.
Boy, can you imagine trying to navigate that situation in today's world of handheld video, everything documented? Yeah. That would be terrifying.
You don't just light up the room, you light up the internet.
Oh, my band recently got to appear in the Guardians of the Galaxy, and I had a scene where I acted alongside Chris Pratt, who's a super nice guy. But he described a situation where he has a hard time, and I don't think this is me speaking out of school. I think would say this to anybody. His situation is now he has a hard time figuring out, like, he can't tell if people really like him, if he's really funny. Like, everywhere he goes as a big movie star, like, everybody just, as you're describing, they laugh and laugh and laugh. Everything he does is the most incredible thing. And it's, I think it's hard to figure out, like, who your real friends are, what the real reaction is to you. Like, I wonder if the masks helped in the last couple of years for people like that.
Well, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I once ran into Getty in an airport, and he had his mask on his face. He had his orange hair all tied up, and he had a wool cap. Absolutely. His assistant came over and say, "Oh, by the way, Getty's over there. Want to say hi?" And there he was, and completely recognized by Rush fans. You know, no hiding under any amount of mask.
Wow.
And he just has to deal with that.
I love that. So I know you got some kids out there in the world, and you're probably pretty good at dispensing wisdom. You've certainly been doing it for the last
plenty of that.
However many minutes. I wonder if you would be willing to try and distill some of this wisdom into a piece of advice you might give a 21-year-old version of yourself working in today's world. What advice do you think you'd give yourself?
Oh, man. Well, myself, I would have given myself advice that I'm glad that I would not have taken. And that advice would have been, relax, dude, it's going to be fine. Don't beat yourself up. Just, you know, enjoy, smell the coffee as it goes by. You know, if I had done that, I never would have gotten anywhere. So relax to enjoy life, but let that anxiety continue to drive you to that 21-year-old guy. As far as specifically the modern world, oh my goodness gracious me. It is such a different world. It's good and bad. There's good news and bad news. The good news is that any darn fool can make a record. You don't need to go to the man. You don't need to go to the big record company and get their expensive studios to cut an album. You can do it at home on your laptop. That's the good news, is that it's been democratized. You know, whoever, you know, like somebody like Moby can make music without playing an instrument, but he creates music. You know, anyone can do it. Homo sapiens are very good at music, and it really is something for all to enjoy. You know, around the campfire, that's the real thing. You know, specialization where I get to do it and you got to buy it and listen to it because you're the audience, I'm the musician, that's actually kind of unnatural. And so the modern world where anybody can do it at home, that's a good thing. Here's the problem. Everybody's doing it. So how do you bust out? How do you get out in front? How do you get more than three people to hear it? Okay, I'm the wrong guy to ask. I should be asking that question to the youngsters. How do you do it? How do you bust through? How does this YouTuber or this Instagrammer suddenly, they got the gazillion following and there's 50 more who don't? And that's a question that people who sell art have been trying to figure out forever. Is they all get airplay one way or another, but some are hits, some are not. Go figure.
You know, this is not a question I normally would have asked over the last couple of years having these conversations, but I feel like you probably are going to have an interesting take on the conversation that keeps coming up these last few weeks, especially the role of AI, the ChatGPT, like everything that's happening. What do you think will keep humans, Homo sapiens, the musical Homo sapien you just described, what will keep us relevant in the face of computer generated, digitally created AI music specifically?
Well, damn. Everyone's kind of reassured by the fact that right now it's kind of crap.
Yeah.
I've partaken thereof myself. And unfortunately, I feed into it a cool, you know, idea, and it comes back with not great stuff. But maybe it's a beginning of something you can work with. So we're all reassured by the fact that it's imperfect and actually not that good. How long is that going to last? Maybe 20 minutes before that AI starts getting really good at stuff. And as consumers, we can be happy. For instance, the drummer's relationship with the drum box, where the drum box, which is a form of AI, plays rhythm, this basic human fundamental elemental aspect of humanity is our rhythm, which we do better than any of the other primates or any other species. We do rhythm is what we do, and rhythm is what music is, and it's the bonding force. It actually causes us to procreate. It causes us to thrust our pudenda in public in a sexually explicit manner. Only music does that, not Shakespeare or any other form. Rhythm does that. And this fundamental animal thing can be done most effectively by a machine. Out on the disco floor, the thing that more than Charlie Watts, more than Clive Stubblefield, a machine gets people dancing and gets those pudenda thrusting. And so, in a way, drummers have been supplanted by machines. But no, they haven't. I'm still banging shit. And there's a different kind of vibe you get from it. And it may be that AI will produce the next huge blockbuster film, one way or another, probably with the wrong number of fingers on several of the characters. But there'll still be room for humble humanity.
Is it choices?
I hope. We're just making this up. You know, I know.
Is it intuition that sets us apart, you apart, from the drum box? Is it
okay? Like, well, this goes back to the fundamental dialectic of Star Trek. You know, Captain Kirk versus Spock. You know, logic versus instinct. Deep imponderables revealed to us in Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. You drummers have been dealing with the AI much longer than everybody else.
And yeah, well, my first thing was to go out and get me one.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a drum box long before they invaded drum world, because I was, you know, playing guitar at home, hamming it up on, you know, And I would try and set up a rhythm first with a hitting a pillow and stuff. But yeah, and then I found this drum box, which was designed to accompany lounge pianist who's playing, you know, piano in the lounge of a hotel. And he has a little drum box. And it had four or five different settings on it. Rock one, rock two, you know, and you can fiddle with the tempo and do a few things. But I could lay down on my Revox A77, one track of that. Then I could jam on that with the guitar. And it was several years later that I think Phil Collins was the first guy to use a drum box that you can actually hear on the record. You can hear, hey, that's not Phil, and he's a famous drummer. That's a machine, proudly. And very soon thereafter, the electronic drum box rhythms, now being able to be programmed with great sophistication on computers, that's when the invasion began. And last time I checked, drummers are still working.
Oh, yeah. Where do you stand on the idea of in the recording studio, a tech lining the drums up to the grid perfectly? Like, is this something that you're all for, or do you think it dehumanizes it?
Lining up to the grid. No, I don't mind that. Quantizing.
Yeah.
Is what you mean. Yeah. Yes. To make it, I don't mind that. If you have to work with a click, if you're not working with a click, if it's just the band, they play the song down, that's one thing. But, and that's a really great way to record. But also another great way to record is to lay down a mechanized rhythm, which is solid. It's not a click. It's a fully developed rhythm with all the nuances of a rhythm that you can program in there. And that's inspiring. So you get that going and you can play yourself some goddamn great guitar and you can play the bass and overdub all the stuff at leisure, whereas in olden times, you had to record the backing track, i.e. the drums first, and that's what you got to work with.
Yeah.
But nowadays, the drummer doesn't have to do all the work first. He can come back later, and he can overdub later. Okay, here's the deal. Now, when it was played viscerally, organically by a band, the groove is fine. But when we're all now playing to the machine, and the drummer adds himself to the machine, he's kind of got to be on the grid.
Yeah.
It just works better if you nudge it this way and you nudge it that way. Maybe you're depriving some humanity. But remember that old disco thing.
Yeah.
We don't mind hearing mechanized rhythm. It's fine. All the little roughs and drags and nuances and changes of volume and expression are still there, but they're all shuffled to be on the grid because Homo sapiens loves that on the dance floor.
Man, Stuart, I feel like I could pick your brain all day long. You're so generous with this, with these deep thoughts of yours, but I don't want to wear out my welcome. Thank you so much for joining me for this. I really appreciate it. You're the best. This is so cool. Shucks. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.